Before I begin, I'm going to change my
I have
internet.
Our residential network is always poor, so I don't say much on Tuesday nights.
Okay, I'm gonna be frozen for like 10 seconds because I'm switching to another line here.
I'm gonna go get some water.
I'm on the main one. There's going to be 3 Zoom calls in my household, but it says my internet connection is unstable. So maybe I should go back to the old one. Okay, I'm going to go back to the old one. Okay, I'm back to the one before I changed. Okay, Randy. Email me a question that I'm going to address about why I didn't mention the references of the Spirit in the Old Testament and the baptism of Jesus and the Spirit descending upon Jesus, and why I referred to Acts 2 as the beginning of the manifestation. Randy is correct. The Spirit has been present throughout the Old Testament and into the New, in the Old Testament in limited ways. Not everyone was gifted. It was basically through the prophets and through people who were building the tabernacle and the vessels, and you know, they're gifted to construct and things like that. With Jesus, he's the Spirit is bestowed. That's more of a Trinitarian type of presence in the baptism. I think I started with Acts because in my mind, I was fixated on the Spirit and the church, which is sort of my emphasis. So in a long class on the Spirit, I would go from the Old Testament and go into the New. But with this more limited, I just cut to the chase and went to the church manifestation. So I hope you can see that aspect. Okay, now I sent you 2 different PowerPoint or keynote presentations. One is the revised number 3, and the other is number 4, which is today's, okay? Now, I wanna go back into, if you have the revised number 3, because part of how I view the church is that I feel that in the New Testament, half of the churches were in some throes of being in trouble. And that's very early in New Testament history. I mean, still the New Testament, and they're in trouble. And if you look at some of the ones that I wrote, I think there's more than half of them. Galatians, church at Galatia, and Hebrews were having major theological problems. One, perhaps denying Christ and going back to Judaism in the letter to the Hebrews. Galatians, thinking about circumcision needed for salvation, a major defection. Then you had a very weird church, the church at Corinth, which was basically a splintered and very selfish church. Okay. That didn't have a Jewish background. It had a very pagan background, like you always thought, like a sailor's town, seaport town. And it was a very bad church, okay? But Paul founded it and was trying to help them grow, okay? Other churches that had trouble, and we cut into the book of the Revelation, is the church at Ephesus, which started really well with the sort of revival, burning these magic books and really showing commitment to Christ, and then settling into a workaholism in the book of the Revelation, chapter 2. Then you have churches like Pergamum and Thyatira in the book of the Revelation, which is basically, there is both moral and theological error creeping in and a tolerance of it within those churches. So in those letters in the book of the Revelation, there's very common, there's some of you who tolerate so-and-so, you know, tolerate that. So that was their issue. Laodicea, church fooling itself because of its wealth. That spells USA, you know. Sardis, the church that is almost dead. And so I look at the New Testament and I see it. I see the tenor of the New Testament as Christ is always asking the church to, okay, I'll use this word, reform itself, or to make the correction, because the church in the New Testament has a tendency of losing sight of its original purpose and call and just living with it. And that's a major problem of the churches. So that's how I view ecclesiology in the New Testament. It's not really like that wonderful, like, you know, so positive, but it's just the way it is. And so I have a tendency when I go into church to try to say, well, what can we make better, you know? And because that's how I view the church in the New Testament. Now, with that, you'd say, well, how do I then figure out what do I do in a church to improve it? Okay. And there lies this topic on the Spirit. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to presentation number 4, which is what we had for today. And I might have spoken about this in part last week, but I'm going to go and revisit it today, okay? I'm going to share screen, and I'm going to go desktop, and I'm going to go Keynote.
Acts 2.
Okay. Keynote, and I'm going to go through the presentation, Jesus and the Spirit, number 4. See how long it takes to get there. Here it is. And you see the screen. Okay. I was trying to limit the manifestations of the Spirit, but to recap or to add from what I had last week, I have 5. Okay, it's sort of a manageable number. And I spoke about some in more length and some in less length. And what I'm going to do is present them, explain the extremes that I see in today's church, and then open it up to whichever one you want to talk about. And we could talk about it extremely practically in terms of church. We could talk about it biblically. We could talk about it theologically. We could talk about how do we become this? Any question you want, I'll open to answer. So the 5 manifestations, is, again, it's one, was a, it's a very bold proclamation. You cannot get away with this without seeing this in the book of Acts, because not that these apostles were not, or disciples were not committed to Christ. It's just when the Spirit was bestowed on them, they could speak publicly to everybody and proclaim the risen Christ in a very bold manner, to the point in which even when leaders did not want them to speak on these things, they would say, oh, we can't stop, you know, we just have to do it. There was this sort of drive in them to proclaim it. The second one is that there was a supernatural presence. Now, this one is debated, because if you, I think I remember and I from last week, if you are cessationist, you basically play down any supernatural presence of the Spirit of God in the church today. If you are Pentecostal and charismatic, which we talked about, you see it every day. And if you're somewhere in between, you welcome its presence, even though it may not be in the same degree. I hold that there can be and should be a supernatural presence of God in our midst in some way. Because I believe that I want to put it that I think through the vehicle of prayer and of the Spirit and of giftedness, more so than ever in the history of people following God, we have the capacity and ability and the empowerment to do some incredible things for God. And I'm talking about in supernatural presence, okay? And I think I mentioned that when you see it, the congregation and people, they're like never the same anymore. They just see God in a different way. Not that you don't sing or you don't, you know, you don't do the other things that we do in church. It's just that there's this supernatural presence and awe that I would say is in the book of Acts that is present. The third is there was extraordinary generosity. That was a mark in the book of Acts. People were just giving and without compulsion and no one was without need and things like that. And I still believe that the presence of the Spirit changes how you view the material things you have, because you have the reality of a spiritual worldview that is present. You see, why I think the Spirit is so important is that reminds us that there's something else out there, that it's not just like what I live in this earth, you know, and how much I make and how, you know. I mean, those are all the responsibilities we have, but there's something, another reality out there that changes that worldview slightly so that we are less holding on to it. You see, and I'll explain that later when we get to the future slides. I mean, people give today, but you wonder if it's the giving because we have a different worldview reality. You know, it's the motivation. The fourth one is probably the one that was most practiced at PBC, gifted participation of the members. And the very famous book that Ray Stedman wrote, Body Life, shared about people using their gifts and sharing and caring for one another. And this was a major aspect of the early church, because it's recorded in three different epistles of Paul. And if we have time, we'll take a look at them. 1 Corinthians, Romans, Ephesians. One could say it was one of the cornerstone teachings of Paul, the spiritual giftedness. And I think I'd shared in one of the classes that I held that the spiritual giftedness can sometimes be tied to one's own, let's say, skill set, that may be tied with the work that we do. So it could be a natural giftedness. But then there's a category in the New Testament that was supernaturally gifted, where it wasn't even tied, because there's no job description of prophet. You know, there's no job description of healing. You can't port those over from your workplace into this. These had to be something very, very different given to you, rather than having the innate talent for it. And I strongly believe that one of the reasons why God allowed PBC to be one of the first modern mega churches, when Ray Stedman was here, was because of the emphasis on giftedness and the Spirit and the participation of the saints. Okay, it's very, very big. The fifth one is interesting because it's transformation by the Spirit's leading. And I mentioned in one of the classes, I don't know if it was Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, because the lectures were slightly different. You have in the epistles, especially in the book of Galatians, it's almost like a reminder of Paul to the church to be led by the Spirit, okay? Which is odd, because in the book of Acts, the Spirit was so overwhelming, you didn't have to ask for the Spirit's leading. The Spirit just, boom, it hits you like a 2x4. You hit over the head and you're spiritually dizzy, you know? That was the Spirit's impact in the book of Acts. What's very interesting in the epistles, and this is one of the kind of interesting spiritual tensions, when Paul is like planting these churches and ministering to them, it is not necessarily that these people automatically would be giving all their stuff to God. No. Actually, after the book of Acts, and when Paul is ministering, he has to tell the people at the church, don't be like your former selves. Put on the mind of Christ. Follow Christ. Those who are led by the Spirit are the real believers in Christ, you know? And so there's this interesting transformation call or exhortation that seemingly was a choice that the believers had to make in these churches, while in the book of Acts, it's just like they all were, you know? And so that's one of the issues, you know, we may want to deal with if you want to know, you know, why is there this sort of like a discrepancy in the power of the Spirit, you know? And this transformation is interesting, and the Spirit's leading. Oftentimes when people talk about the Spirit's leading, they're talking about what am I to do, or where am I to go? Because we think of the Spirit's leading as a sort of a guidance in life, you know, to make the right choice. And when you read in the New Testament, the Spirit's leading really has some of that, because you have the Spirit leading Paul into like, oh, don't go here, go here. But most of the Spirit's leading is about what you do in terms of morality, not like arguing with people, beating people up. And the second aspect of the Spirit's leading, so if I go back, the first aspect of the Spirit's transformation is changing our behavior, okay? The fruit of the Spirit is this, the fruit of the flesh is this. The fruit of the Spirit is very interesting, because that's an inward transformation of demeanor, a peace, a love, joy. And so to understand this, it's for me, the Spirit's leading and the Spirit's presence, if it's understood the right way, isn't that you always make the right decision, and the right decision always leads to like less problems in life because we made the right decision. The Spirit's leading actually changes you inwardly, so that maybe you're not the angry person anymore. It's a love, joy, peace, which is really unusual, because it's an inward change, okay? And that is very clearly a manifestation of the Spirit from the book of Galatians chapter 5. That's why I always, when I was, I'm pastor now, okay? I always think when I was a pastor, then I remind myself, I'm a pastor now, you know? I was a pastor in San Francisco and a pastor in Chicago. I was always mindful that the elders would not be burnt out. Because, like, in the churches that I was at, oftentimes the elders, we would meet and we'd have to deal with, like, all the like administrative stuff, and you know, we'd meet to late at night and things like that. And what happens is that the elders were tasked with so much stuff, because in a strange way, because you didn't have number four and gifted participation, the elders were left to with like doing so much stuff, you know, they have to do it. They got to meet, we got to make this decision. They're all tired, man. I used to joke around in the sermon, and it was not a joke. It was not a joke. I'm just going to stop this and just talk. It was not a joke. I'd say it as a joke, so it looks less, sounds less offensive. But I used to say when I was pastoring in Chicago, I mean, in San Francisco, I said, you could always tell the leaders of, the, of any church, they're the most haggard and tired of all the people. And I said, that shouldn't be. I mean, because we're people led by the Spirit. But what has happened, the church has become people that got to make the decision and where the buck stops. And so we tend to be tired and haggard and stuff like that. And that's why I believe that one of the first manifestations of the Spirit's presence in the church is the transformation of the leadership, where things become joyful. I know in my own life, that was one of the things, and I'll say this, God had to kick out of me, because, okay, I'm Chinese, right? So dutiful, right? And so responsible, you know? And that's what the Asian church is, okay? That's how they do leadership. They're the ones that go to all the meetings. They're the ones that decide all the stuff. They're the ones that take care of everything, okay? And the problem was, and I share this very often, I became depressed as a pastor. Now I'm thinking, this has got to be crazy. Depressed as a pastor. And here's the thing. My church was growing in San Francisco. It had grown when I first got there. There was maybe under 300 people. When I left with the kids, there's probably 1,200 people. So the church had grown fourfold in the 19 years that I was there. We doubled our floor space because we had a large building project, and it wasn't remodeling. It was actually, we doubled. We bought new property across the way, and we had campuses, two properties across the street from each other. And so all the numerical numbers were very healthy at our church. We had, by the time I left, we had four worship services. Okay. We had one of the largest sanctuaries, most modern sanctuaries in the Bay, in San Francisco. Very healthy financially. And I was dying inside. I was absolutely dying inside. And, you know, I could always preach well, you know. I'm dying on the inside because something was missing. And what was missing was a reliance upon God and His Spirit. And I needed a transformation really bad. Okay. So I'll share the story with you that I think I've shared it before, that the Lord collapsed my world. He collapsed it by having me not pastor anymore because I resigned. I couldn't do it anymore. And then I came down with autoimmune disorder. And it was really bad the first 2 years. Very, very bad. Fatigue and arthritis. And I got into teaching in seminary. And I remember doing lectures, 4-hour lectures, and then sleep in the next 2 days until the next day I do 4 hours of lecture. And that was my life. Because it's physically decrepit. And God took everything away from me. And it's a very humbling thing. He also took away money too, because I made in 2008 as a pastor, I made $145,000 a year. That's what they paid me 12 years ago, which was on the high level for Chinese churches. Like, unheard of that someone's getting paid that much, you know. And I took the job as a seminary professor at $45,000 a year. Okay, so you got you. I got all this. Okay, so I got all this stuff going on. Okay, I tell you, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It kicked the literal crap out of me. But it was the best thing. I had to rely upon God just to wake up in the morning. I had to rely upon God. And I finally understood what faith was. Like, I had to rely upon God. And I had to say to God, I said, look, if I'm going to do anything else for you, you're going to have to work through me, because I don't have any more energy anymore. I can't do it. Emotionally, I don't want to do it. Physically, I can't do it anymore, God. And I remember grappling with God those years. And I tell you, I was in my 50s when that happened. And God was very merciful to me. And he taught me things that I needed to learn when I was in my 30s, but I only learned when I was in my 50s. And I learned about the presence of God, the power of God, and the ability to transform someone like me in the inner person. And I'm relatively very happy now. And, you know, I love teaching. I love preaching. I still do that. But it's no longer a chore for me. It's not a chore at all. And it's really hard to explain this, because you can do it. And so let's say outside, vintage 2005 Jeff and 2020 Jeff. Well, perhaps on the outside, you wouldn't be able to tell as much difference. But I could tell. I don't want to be the 2005 Jeff anymore. Don't want to be him at all. I want to be where I am now, because I'm at peace with who I am and with what I do. And I believe it's the Spirit's transformation that allowed me to learn that. And I believe in America, a lot of people are still caught in performance and lack that transformation of the heart of joy, you know. And so, you know, I do my best. In a strange way, in the past, if I did my best, it had to result in something positive, or I would have second-guessed myself. I didn't work hard enough. Now I do my best and say, look, Lord, it's you anyway. So who am I to get down on myself? It's a very interesting transformation. Now, I credit that to that fifth point, which is the transformation of the Spirit. And it's something that, in a strange way, you can't teach. You could only experience and be transformed. Because I don't think it's because, oh, I read a new scripture that I wasn't aware of. I went to Dallas Seminary. I was 7 years there, you know. I knew the Bible very well. It wasn't the lack of knowledge. It was the lack of what I think faith is really in the life of a believer, and the presence of the Spirit's life to transform. And so partly in saying this, I don't want to give the impression that, you know, oh, if we just do these 10 things and we can do these, we will all be at this church like that. No, it's actually gut-wrenching to realize what you are really lacking in. Oh man, it was, man. And, but I count it as a blessing, you see. I would tell people, I wouldn't want anyone to go through what I went through, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Okay. And so I think next week we'll talk about the process of how do you become someone who is joyful and transformed in the power of God, you know? And we'll talk about those things next week, as the Lord gives us time to talk about these things. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go back to my screen sharing, and I'm gonna go back to the desktop, and go back to this. And in these five manifestations, I thought about like what was the extreme in the New Testament and what we practice now. So in bold proclamation, I saw that they were proclaiming, if we proclaim a truth in similar degree and tone as in the New Testament, that would be like we've arrived. We're speaking like what they were talking about, the apostles, the disciples, you know. But what we have now is we proclaim selective truths that Christ can assist us in attaining select cultural and societal values. That's what I see is like what preaches today. And it's different. It's just a different type of focus, supernatural presence, from seeing God in power via supernatural gifting and prayer. You'll see that prayer is a very, very important concept for me. And what oftentimes you have is the creation of the atmosphere of the presence of God and focus upon our works. So it's the creation of the atmosphere. One of my favorite churches, and I mentioned this, is a church in San Francisco, Cornerstone. And love the people dearly. But they spend an extraordinary amount of time creating the atmosphere in worship with the lighting and the music, and, you know, everything's just got to be right. You know, it's just got to be right. And you see that a lot. You could always tell when I guess speak at a number of churches in the Bay Area, and usually when they go over the worship, they have this list schedule. And sometimes it's down to the minute. Okay, at 07, you're on. Okay, at 08, you're on. At this time, the light comes on, and this. And I'd say, and the whole thing is to make it look like it's the most casual church ever. But really, it's the most obsessive compulsive church ever, made to look like it was the most casual church ever. And they do that all the time. I mean, the most casual looking churches are the most sort of agonizing in terms of timing and things like that. Just got to be right. And it's just the way, it's just the way big churches, you know, big churches. I could go on with this, and I'm not saying you create a bad atmosphere, you know, have the temperature at 105 and, you know, have, you know, no lights. I'm not saying that, but there's a point in which, you could see the extremes, you know, are you creating it or is it the presence of God there? If the presence of God there, you don't really need to create it as much, actually, you know. The third one is extraordinary generosity, giving and sharing from the heart based upon a changed worldview that places, and I got to do, I'm gonna do a typo change here, the spiritual reality over the this world reality. And what we have is we give to change this world's reality, which is not bad, but it's really interesting. In the book of Acts, they gave because they knew that there was something else beyond. And so they gave as stewards rather than, you know, giving for this world without that heavenly reality. Okay. The fourth one, gifted participation, the realization and mobilization of each believer's giftedness as a service to God and his body. That's 1 Corinthians right there. And churches become the recruitment of members to volunteer for programming and projects of the church. And I know that. I've been. Here's the devil in large church. Like, I've pastored churches of 70. I've pastored churches of over 1,000, okay? And I've seen every 70 became like 150, 300 became 1,000. So I saw like every person added, you know, to get to the next number. And I will tell you something. As the church got bigger, there were just more things I had to sort of focus on in terms of managing the church, helping the church to manage because of just the sheer size of it. And we didn't have the space. And it was always a battle I had. I think the battle got much harder because I pastored Asian churches. And back then, Asian churches had high degree of church membership participation in them. Usually minority churches have higher degrees of participation because there's a community aspect to worship too. But in your mega church, you tend to have churches that are attracting churches based upon either the speaker or you have a good children's ministry that you can bring your children to, or you have a good music ministry. And so it's not necessary that people come because they want to utilize their giftedness. They come because they want to hear a speaker, or you have a service that can provide for my children. And so it just became more and more. And there's a, you know, I'm not as gung-ho of large churches anymore because I see the inherent danger in them because they have this natural tendency to become overly administrative. Okay. It's just that. Like when the church was small, like if a church is 400, I can know pretty much everyone's name. And if the church is 200, I pretty much went to everyone's house for dinner, or they went to my house for dinner. Once the church cracks over 1,000, I don't know everyone's name anymore. I don't go to everyone's house for dinner. It's too many. I can't befriend everyone. and it just changes the gifted participation. And the final, the transformation by the Spirit's leading, both a changed outward behavior and a changed inward demeanor based upon Galatians chapter 5. And it morphs into directional leading, like what are we to do, that are not linked to the aforementioned concepts. So it becomes decision-making process rather than a transformational process, which is a very important distinction in the New Testament, because the New Testament was still always more concerned about the transformation of the individual in Christ than getting the church to do more stuff. Okay. And I see with these slides what can be, and then perhaps kind of what they are in many churches today, you know? And I'm kind of, I love what church can be. And what church is, I know that that's what it is in America, you know? And so that's what I wanted to share formally. What I want to do now is, if there's anything that you want to talk more about, any of these five manifestations or another manifestation, it could be biblical, practical, theological, how do I become that myself? Any question, okay? Because I want it to be, to leave time for you to interact. So we got about an hour. And so I'm going to open up for any questions, discussions that you'd like to talk about.
Question for you.
Yeah, Eric.
Would you say, and this is, I think this was number 5, 4, 2, the supernatural presence one. Do you think, and this is sort of the, we have this treasure in earthen vessels concept. Is it kind of essential that things are a little off kilter or messy or imperfect? Like, you kind of have to see that in order for the Spirit to sort of be evident in some way? Like, you talked about the hyper, you know, analytical church trying to program its way to being as casual looking as possible, which sort of seems like the opposite of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like being sloppy and being, it's not like you want to be, you know, disastrous and chaotic, but
authentic, let's say. You are who you are. I think that with the Spirit, if you'd say, what do I envision a good worship service in this Spirit to be? That it is 59 minutes long every Sunday is not on top of the list. Okay, it's not on top of the list, okay. The fact that the lights come on at the right time and the music comes on at the right time of the prayer is not it. I enjoy reading about body life in Ray Stedman's book when I was a teenager. And the spontaneity of people sharing and people gathering in prayer to pray for someone and people sharing what they had to fulfill need. That's one of the reasons why I enjoy the Step Closer service, because it has that spontaneity of people sharing, and then people, Andy would say, oh, well, let's come up and pray for this person, you know? And then they go up and they pray for this person. I mean, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. It's a great thing, you know? And so I think that sort of spontaneity that really captures the real life journey of people in the service. And I think that's what I would see. It really ministered to people, and people can minister to others. I think that what church worship and has become, it has become a spectator sport. And I'm not sure that is what it was supposed to be. I think it was, we participated in this, you know, in praise, in giving and caring for people, you know, it was participation. And so, like before we joined up with PBC, we would go to Menlo and listen to John Ortberg. And that's the king of spectator. I mean, it was the king of spectator church, you know. But my wife liked to go there, you know. So she was healing from past experiences in the Chinese church, being a pastor's wife. But it was the king of spectator. You just go in and you go out. No one knows you. You have to have people whose assignment is to greet you, or you wouldn't be greeted, because it's not a natural thing to be greeted at Menlo. You have to assign greeters, you know. You know, that's really fake when you have to assign greeters, because no one really wants to greet you, you know? And it was really well presented, you know? But it wasn't, it didn't manifest the spirit. Okay.
Yeah, one of the best, let me close with this, but one of the best services, there was one where some people remember this, Steve Zeisler was supposed to preach, and he was stuck in San Diego because of fog, and he couldn't fly up. I forget if it was late Saturday night or early Sunday morning. And so Scott, somebody called him up and said, "Hey, Scott, can you come preach?" Mm. And he sort of prayed, and he came, and he decided, you know, I'm not going to preach a message. I think what the Lord wants us to do this morning is just have a, it's all body life this morning, just sharing stories, seeing what the Lord's doing. And the amazing thing was Janice's father, who's very kind of grew up in a kind of bizarre Catholic thing, has really rejected the, you know, Jesus. He was there and he said, "Oh my goodness, if this is what being a Christian is like, this is fantastic. Yeah. This is the best service I've ever been to."
Yeah. So, 'cause it's authentic. You cannot rehearse that.
Right.
And there lies like, that which is authentic and not rehearsed because it is genuine. I think that is what the world is craving for. That which is authentic. We pray for you because, yeah, we always pray for people, you know? We share because we always share. We're honest because that's what we are. We're honest people, you know? And, you know, it's just, those are wonderful times. I'm glad you share that, Eric. Christine, you had to throw your hand up, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering, because you mentioned that you've been to a lot of churches around the Bay Area. Is there a church that you've seen that seems the most authentic? Or, I mean, because I have had this fear that PBC is getting a little toward the planned and organized and
the
scripted.
Movement is that all the major churches that are big are there. I mean, they're very structured and planned. Okay. And in terms of that which is casual, that by default, the smaller churches that doesn't have the funds or the people tends to be more casual. It's like I church planted an Indian church with some friends of mine prior to PBC. So I have a church planting background too. The church is in Milpitas. So the church has about 70, mostly Indian high-tech workers. But the Indian culture tends to be very family-oriented, you know. And I'm not going to stereotype, but the kids win spelling bees and all, you know, all that, you know, they're really big on, you know, education and everything. And I always think of the spelling bee. It's always the Indian person winning the spelling bee. God forgive me for saying that, but it's always, it's usually true though, you know. And so what they have is the worship. The band are the children of the parents who are like 12 to 15 years old playing in the band, leading worship. And I'm saying, hey, this is wonderful. It's wonderful because the kids are learning to worship with their parents and they're learning involvement in the service. Okay, in a real large church, make sure the kids, you know, because we gotta have some sort of a standard, you know. But in the smaller church, hey, that's what we got, you know, because we can't afford this guy, you know. And what you can't afford, you know, in a strange way, becomes a real blessing, because then, you know, people just like, oh, you know, they're like, whatever instruments they have, they're bringing it up there, you know. And it's very refreshing. It's very refreshing when you see that. Now, if you're, you know, professional music leader, you'd probably say, oh man, what is this? You know, this sort of so amateur hour, you know. I don't quite see it that way, you know. In terms of spontaneity, it's one of my favorite churches that I go to. And I used to speak here about two. There's a number of churches that I make my rounds in the Bay Area. So one of them was this really unusual Chinese church. It has maybe like 500 people in it. It meets in a former HP R&D property around Bowers off 280. And so I go in there and the people really dressed up. The staff is really dressed up. That's the one where I shared that I once came in with a suit with a light colored shirt with a colored tie. And I felt I was too casual. I felt like I needed to wear white shirt and black tie. I mean, and my translator had a head covering. Okay. So we're talking about a real, at least from leadership, that kind of church. When I, in the worship, these people are like, they're just like people in the congregation playing their instruments, you know? And these people, mostly from China, mainland China now, they're singing their hearts out, man. Holy cow, they're like singing their hearts out and they're like praising God and all this stuff. And then during the prayer time, they're like, people are standing up, giving public prayer to God, you know? And then someone else would stand up and give public prayer to God and everything. And I said, wow, this is nice, you know? They all giving public praise to God for this. And it's like, this is a wonderful thing, you know? I believe that the more participation you have by the congregation is a very healthy thing, expression, because the church has become very professional in terms of just sit there, you know? Let the professionals organize this for you. And having been in a number of churches and been guest speakers and know what goes behind the scenes, a lot of it is inauthentic. It's manufactured, which is like something I'm against. You know, I think you should be who you are, you know? And if you're casual and that's who you are, then you're casual. Yeah, but if you're uptight, then have an uptight service, you know? Oh, we can't. No. And so that really troubles me. I think the original body life concept, and I read Body Life when I was trying to decide which seminary to go to was so refreshing to me, and still is part of what I think is good ecclesiology in terms of people's participation and valuing people. And, you know, it's up there. It's up there. Now, I also think there's the preaching can be prophetic in tone. You know, there are different aspects to worship, you know. But time was, 59 minutes is not a, was not one of the characteristics of spirit-led worship. You know, what you'd have is, you really want to know, like, some miraculous things. If you have, like, public sharing, and someone shares something, and then someone says, you know what? That was exactly what I needed to hear. Like, how does that work? It wasn't even planned, you know? I mean, you will see more of that than you ever have before, because people will be leading people in the spirit to say things. And it's not like the spirit totally controls you, so you're just like mouthing, you're the parrot, you know what you're saying, okay? But you'll be moved to say things because of edification of someone who needs to hear it. It's crazy. But the more you that happens, the more you will see that occur. And you wonder, how does the timing work on that? And it's the Spirit of God moving amongst this people to say things. Gene, I saw your hand up.
I've been thinking about this. And I think it's wonderful when we could have participation and it's authentic. The issue that I have been concerned about with public sharing, and it's wonderful when it works, but it tends to be there's an accepted sense that the church, that Christians are meant to be triumphant. And therefore, to speak about failure, needs, troubled faith, prayer not answered, those kinds of things don't get shared. And one of the reasons is that if you share a need publicly, then someone with great intentions comes over to help you solve that problem. That's the last thing you need. What you need is someone to kind of stand with you in this situation. So I'm not being very articulate, but I think this is a legitimate issue for a church which relies a lot on public sharing.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing, Gene. I think you're absolutely correct. I've been in churches, and I was ordained in the church in Dallas, Texas, Richland Bible Fellowship. So I'm ordained in the Bible Church movement. Their sharing got really stale. And this was in the early 80s, very stale. And it had lost the authenticity. And it may be because it was in Richardson, Texas, which is an upper middle class growing community. My experience with Step Closer is that usually they're talking about need and failure. So with the Step Closer, with the people in the recovery, it's usually not like, oh, I've triumphed and, you know, I'm wonderful now. And, you know, it's like they're always praying for need. And I think that's what makes it very authentic for me. It's the degree of sharing. But I think that group, because it's in the recovery group, they're used to sharing that. And it's not shameful to them. And it's a nice thing. I think in a public service, you have to really be careful that it doesn't degrade into triumphantism or, you know, I have a friend of a friend whose dog is sick, you know, that type of, you know, trivial type of, you know, prayer, things like that. It's really neat that it really reflects need. And I think that could be taught or controlled by, you know, the leadership and what they say and share. And but I'd give it a crack. I'd give it a try. I think it's a good thing to have. Okay. You know, I shared the book that I wrote, not the book, the chapter I wrote on this book last week. I shared you the chapter on the Holy Spirit in the local church that I wrote. And what we would have, and partly we were really stressed for time. I'll tell you, you know, because we were in San Francisco, we had no parking lot. Okay. Imagine PBC, no parking lot, and the sanctuary is half the size of PBC with the same amount of people as PBC, with one quarter of the classrooms as PBC. Half the sanctuary, one quarter of the classrooms, no parking. Okay. That's San Francisco, because property is really expensive and lots are 25 by 100. They're shotgun lots, 25 feet wide, 100 feet long. That's a housing lot. And so we built this property that was four lots, which was unheard of, that we bought four continuous lots. Yeah, 100 by 100 feet. Okay, that's like, for San Franciscans, that's like, wow, you hit jackpot, 100, you know, for the suburbs. What are you talking about, you know? Our emergency exit for fire lane is bigger than that, you know? I mean, it's like, what are you talking about, you know? And so we were really pressed for time, because we had a school around there, so there was some street parking. Maybe 10 spots, you know, I mean, you know, that we get. And a lot of people drove, you know, even in San Francisco. So we had to clear out, so just so that people can, you know, free up the spaces, you know. And we had four services, you see. And so what we did is, we didn't have open sharing. What we did was, we had open prayer request. And they met, solve some of the thing concerns that Gene had, because the prayer request usually is not triumphant. Okay, every so often I give thanks to God for the answered prayer, and then the whole congregation would erupt. But usually, before someone gave thanks, we prayed for that person months before, and we would intercede. So it wasn't really open mic. But when someone offered a prayer request and we got it, oftentimes I would say, contact the person and say, hey, can we pray for you publicly in the service? And every so often I'd say, hey, could you come up to the worship service and share your requests publicly? And then we go in intercession for that person. And so that helped some with this issue, because I know there's still time restraints in services, especially when you have a lot of services and space is really tight. And we tried to control it, because there's always these people that just want to, they like talking, you know? So it's an open sharing. It's the same five people that are talking all the time, you know? And they're hogging up everything, you know? And you don't want that either. So, you know, there's a degree of management of what is happening. So, you know, good and bad things to manage, things to oversee. But generally, in terms of the modern worship service, I find it too professional. too professional. Okay. Any other question or any other comments? Yes, Mavis, you're on mute. Mavis. Yes.
So we talk about the five manifestations in the early church. I believe it only lasted for not long time. But I also see that it seems the size of the church is also important. Smaller size is easier to, like, say, close, authentic, yes, and like one body. But today, I mean, church are all going after growth in numbers rather than, you know, the transformation of the hearts in the congregation. So should it be that, like, the direction of the church should be shifted? I mean, if we have more smaller churches, would it be maybe it would be better for all these to be realized in modern world instead of, you know, going after bigger and bigger church, you know, generating more and more offering, and then we can build bigger buildings or I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mavis. I'll share a story. I love sharing stories. I have two daughters, and both, I told you one went to a church plant when she was a student at UCLA and stayed with that church plant until she left LA and came up north. And the church merged with another church that had a facility. They had people. They merged with the church that had a facility. The church is still not really big. You know, a few hundred, maybe 500 people. My other daughter, she also went to UCLA. The joke was she went to John MacArthur's church. And she was a deacon at John MacArthur's church because she led like a small group there while she was a student. But when she got married and had kids, they realized they didn't want that church experience anymore. And they were looking for small. And so they eventually settled down in when they went to Maryland, a small church plant, maybe 50 people, PCA, Presbyterian Church of America. And then when they came to the Bay Area, they went to a small church plant of about 100 people, 60 of them were kids. Okay, 40 of them were adults. And both my daughters crave the small church experience because of the intimacy they're in. I think PBC is my last pastorate. But let's say God extends my life and I have another one after this. It'll be small church. Because there's an inherent advantage in the small church just for the fact that you can know everybody and minister to them. It's such
an
advantage.
And you'll probably grow it to a big church again.
And then it's like, God's too big, you know, it's like, I don't want it anymore. But it is a vicious cycle, you know, that like I used to, when I pastored in San Francisco, we used to have the young adults group over at my house every Friday night. That's when we met. And we'd have like 50 young adults at my house. Every corner of my house in San Francisco that we rented, they were there. It was great because I knew everybody, but because it was so intimate, it got bigger and bigger and bigger until we couldn't even fit it in my house and we had to move to the church. Then you move to the church and that's not the same anymore. You see? And I still, some of my closest friends are the people I pastored in Chicago when I went to everyone's house and they came to my house probably a few times every year. We knew everybody, you know? And it's something about community, you know? Community. I think it's just harder to do and you have to emphasize the group's dynamics. But I feel that a health, if I were to plan a church, okay, I would say will have smaller, nimble missionary missional churches. Once they get about 300, let's just start another one, you know, just like. But 300 in the Bay Area is a strange number, because that means you don't have any diverse ministry. You know, you don't have all the options. But you do have the intimacy, you know, you do have the intimacy. And there's something about intimacy and care for people that you can't get in a large church. You see? And I think that's, it bothers me, you know. When we retire, and it's possible that if my kids go and live in the East Bay because of housing prices, we will move with them, okay? And my wife and I said, what church will we go to? She said, I don't know. She said, it's got to be a small one, because we basically had it with big church. Been there. I don't know. Doesn't give me joy anymore. Yes, Hannah, I see your hand up.
Yeah, hi. So, maybe I share an experience too, but I think the question is really, why do you go to church? Why do people go to church? So when I lived in Germany, so I was raised Catholic, but I would really only go to church because of the spiritual experience. Sorry, that sounds a little bit cliche, maybe. I don't know a better word for it, but it was just, whatever, as you said, the atmosphere, the overall experience, and you know, the Catholic Church actually does a very good job doing this, whatever you think about it. So when I came to the United States, of course, I left the church already when I lived in Germany, so I was not really a churchgoer. But when I came to United States, it was, I had a neighbor. She was, I'm not sure if she was Catholic or Christian. But anyway, I was looking for, so I thought, well, I'm really confused about all the different churches. I really don't know what it's all about. And so I was looking for a teacher at a, I was in LA to learn English. To learn better English was actually hard to find, believe it or not. But one of the professors of the schools I called up, she said, well, why don't you join a church? And I thought, wow. That was the last thing I would think about, joining a church to learn better how to speak English. And she said, well, you will meet people too. You know, you meet people, you learn, you have experience speaking. And it was to me the most outrageous thing. I thought, wow, that was never a reason why I would join a church. So I think in some ways it's cultural too. But I see what you're saying in regards to the spontaneity and authenticity, sorry. and I had the same impression. Let's say in the beginning, I went a few times to the recovery Friday night at PBC, and I loved it. Everyone was just getting up and saying whatever they wanted to say was on their mind. It was very not rehearsed at all, very authentic. And the music and then the, you know, the food, and it was just very different, as you say, compared to the regular service, where you have to sit still and be quiet. And I respect that, of course. I just wanted to share that. I think we need to ask ourselves, why do we go to church? What is it what we expect, what we want to get out of this. And I still go to church because I want to be inspired by the spirit, as you said, spiritually inspired, and is my main reason. So of course it's nice to meet people, to be in, to make good relationships, to all that is a really nice thing that hopefully comes with it. But for many people, it doesn't. I mean, I heard people saying, they said, I never went to anyone's house. I've been with this church for 30 years or whatever. I never, you know, even at PPC, sorry, I heard someone saying this, you would not expect it from, because I thought, oh, wow, this is, seems to me a very outgoing person and knows a lot of people, and wow, I cannot believe this. So sorry, I want to stop, but I think it's a key question. Why do I go to church? And
thanks for sharing, Hannah. I think, you know, I mentor some unusual people. One of the people I mentor, and I talk to him maybe once every 2-3 months, is an Episcopalian deacon in the Bay Area. And he sought me out and says, I'm spiritually dying. I need someone to direct me. So I said, sure, let's meet. And we, even with the shut-in, we don't meet as much, but we talk on the phone. And it's very interesting. He, because he's Episcopalian, and Episcopalian is high church, it's probably closest to Catholic worship, where it's focused upon the Eucharist. And so, and they have the common book of prayer, and they would read. It's very formal. It's very high church formal. And he would always say, he's looking for a new church because he's thinking about leaving the Episcopalian church because he's a little bit more theologically conservative than the average Episcopalian church. But he had uncles that were bishops. I mean, his family's all Episcopalian, like his nephew's a priest, you know. And he would say, oh, you know, I've been to PPC. I just can't get into the singing. I just want hymns, you know. And when you were sharing, I was thinking of this person, and I could understand, because like, yeah, there are different aspects of meditation and worship and singing. That is also part of the fabric of what worship is. It's also a cultural expression of what you are, how you were raised and things like that. I think the aspects I'm talking about are different types of aspects. You know, we'll be talking a little bit more about this in the last semester when I talk about ecclesiology, what I think a healthy church is. And so it really kind of reveals my low church background. I've got high church and low church. I'm really low church, you know, really low church, you know. And so understand high church. Actually, if I were to like redo church, I would have one service that's high church and another service that's low church. And for the high church are the people like organ and singing hymns and standing up, and the music director going like this, you know, and let's say, oh, let's sing verse number 4 again, you know, and they'll sing verse number 4 again, and you know, they'll sing blessed assurance, Jesus is mine, you know. And then there'll be low church where people are sharing. And because I understand the cultural expression of what people feel comfortable with too, you know. But I some of these things of the spiritual awe and the prayer and the participation in the body of the church, I think can transcend both high and low church in some manner, you know. But it's a very interesting thing. Thanks for sharing, Hannah. Thanks for sharing. Any other comments, questions, anything you'd like to talk about? We have about maybe 15, 20 minutes left. Yes, Mavis.
I want to talk about the transformation.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that's because in the early church, it's such a supernatural presence of God. It seems like leaving you no choice. But now, I've known people who have been coming to church for like 30 years or more, and it doesn't seem like their life has been changed a lot.
Yes.
And a lot of them, actually. And so I'm wondering, if this church going, this involvement doesn't really transform a person. So is this like a decision of an individual, or how is that, compared to, the early church? Why is that? It seems like, so we say the spirit is powerful, but sometimes you don't see that in every person's life. Some people have that, but a lot of them don't. So can we still claim that, this spirit is powerful, and this word has transformational power?
I forget what I shared in this evening class and the Wednesday morning class. And I think I said something in the morning class that I didn't share here. And so if I said it, please forgive me. First, in the New Testament, the instant transformation is clearly seen in the book of Acts. I mean, the Spirit overpowered people. Wow. But once you get to the epistles, especially in the letters of the Apostle Paul, he had to encourage them to be this. It's just very different. It's like, wow, how come they have to be encouraged? Well, in the book of Acts, they just like, we just automatically gave, And then in the epistles, Paul has to say, okay, be ready to share so you could hold on to, what is life indeed in the age to come, And I think that for the average church life, it is the epistles that is what you're going to see. That it's not going to be automatic. Now, I believe also that there's a small percentage that is automatic. Like if you were in a Pentecostal tradition, the concept of deliverance you would be really familiar with, which would be you got an issue. We're going to gather, we're going to lay our hands upon you, and boom, you're going to be delivered, okay? Because it's instantaneous, it's almost passive, okay? If you're non-Pentecostal, then you don't really see life as that always deliverance. You think it's a journey that has a bunch of decisions you got to make, and it's a slow process of change. Now, I can see deliverance in maybe 5% of maybe 1% of Christian experience. Actually, when you see deliverance, the instantaneous work of God, it takes your breath away. Wow, that's something. But I would think that about 95 to 99% is the way of the Apostle Paul, where he's telling you, okay, now put your mind on things of the Spirit. Don't be led by the flesh. He has to almost like ask them to steer their life the right way. In terms of why you don't see it, okay, I believe that when Ray Stedman was pastor here, he would teach this about spiritually mindedness, and if you don't, if you'll say, let's say in one quarter of your message, you keep on saying, but look, so many of us are steered by the values of this world, and we're drowning in it. You have to have the mind of Christ and the mind of the Spirit, and focus, be led by the Spirit. It's a it's a spiritual battle and a mind change, you see, rather than, oh, you need to do these things. You see, it's this battle of the mind change. What are your values? What are, you got to be led by the spirit. You know, you got to, now, if you were to teach that, let's say consistently, let's say one quarter of the time, you're bringing it up in some message form. Okay. Even if it's 1 minute in passing, it would be a consistent teaching. And then people who come would know that's one of the things we got to do. We just gotta not be molded by the values of this world. We have to put our minds upon Christ and put our trust in him. And, you know, just keep on saying that. And if you don't, people will never do it. Okay. And I think that's a good thing to remind people of, actually. It's a good, because it's a spiritual battle. I think most of the battle is here or here, you know. It's not really of the hands, you know. It's of the faith type of aspects of the believer. And I think also we don't, I don't know, challenge believers enough. Always, when I was preaching regularly, that was over a decade ago, I would think that there was something in every believer that I had to deconstruct because their value is wrong. So I was always deconstructing their values and challenging them to reconstruct it in Christ. You see, and I thought that was a very important facet of what I needed to do, because we bring a lot of the values we have from our culture into the church, and it's not challenged enough. You know, we're this way. We got to be this way. I mean, you know, with different cultures, you have different sort of baggage we have. I still have hope that if you proclaimed and you relied upon God, you could see this change in people. I have hope. I have hope that it's still, because I'm in that sense, I'm very old school in terms of how church should operate, how people grow. You know, I'm not, I know enough people who pastor large churches whose lives are miserable. And a lot of them have fallen or in scandal. That doesn't impress me at all. I wouldn't want anyone to be like that. I'd rather be authentic and be all flawed, you know, than to pretend that I have everything, you know, and then you find me out that I'm not that way, you know. It's sort of like, oh man, what are you doing, Jeff? It's terrible. People, ministers, big ministers commit suicide, all sorts of, you know, tragedy, family mess. It's all there. It's all there. And partly is really being authentic of really who you are and of the spirit's growth in you, not pretending or anyone, not anything else, but, you know, proclaiming Christ, you know, that's important. Okay. One or two more questions or themes. Thank you, Mavis. Yes, Carl.
Yeah, I want to say that I support George Abraham's small group at PBC, and I think that's a way to be involved in a large church.
Yes,
we talked about large churches quite a bit, is to be in a small group, and that's a good small group. George knows how to organize a group, and I've been involved in that group for several years, and you learn how to pray with people at the VA Hospital Ministries. You learn how to pray with people at the shut-in homes that George does. So I'm going to put a plug in that that's a good ministry.
Yeah.
Involved in a small ministry at PBC, if you really want to be involved, my message.
Yeah. I think what Carl shared is worth its weight in gold. I mean, I'm involved in a small group. Mavis is in the small group that I'm in. And it's very small. There's like five families in that this thing. And but we get to really share and get to know each other. And that's probably the best avenue for a large church to put its huge emphasis upon developing people who can shepherd in smaller groups. It has to be huge. It cannot be the side thing. It has to be, this is because everyone's yearning for community, right? We're not yearning to do more things. And as you know, people pray for people, that's where it can occur. What happening is that I think less and less people have time and the energy to lead and commit to this. I think in maybe a generation earlier, people had their life more centered around church more. And so that was more common. Now it's centered less on church. So it's harder to find leaders who will like be committed every, you know, if you meet every week or twice a month, every, you know, regularly to do this. That's why my daughters, like I boast about my daughters, you know, both, one of my daughters was an elder when she was in the Bay Area and did community groups, and the other did community groups, and they went to church every week and they financially supported the church. You know, those people, they're worth their weight in gold now in church. Wow, your daughters led community groups? Wow, they were there every week. They support. That's like not the average person anymore. You know, that's the superstar now. I said, oh, back then that was like the average person. You know, I mean that's, and so we lowered the standard. But the small group is where it's at. You know, when I teach this class and I do the Sunday, I do the Wednesday morning, I really feel that I get to know you all more because I see you regularly. I know you more. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to get to know you, you know. I think that's what makes church good as you grow together, you know. Makes it wonderful. Yeah. So small groups is it. I'm a big person. I'd simplify church. You got your worship, you got your children ministry, youth, because children are really important, and you got your small groups, and you pour like so much energy on small groups because that's your bread and butter of how people really grow. You see, you really just put a lot of emphasis in that. You develop people, and you just organize that because then you'd see the giftedness of the saints. See. How do you foster the giftedness of the saints? The giftedness of the saints mostly is for building up of other believers. Very few of the gifts were non-edifying. They all had an effect upon the other person. And so it's like, well, where do you give opportunity for that at church? And, you know, there's various times, but in the group, smaller group is where you can have that opportunity to do it, you know, and it's a wonderful thing. When I pastored in San Francisco, I believed in these theories so much that I did an audit of everyone who, of all the ministries that Sunset Church, that's what we were called in San Francisco, and how many people participated in it. and whether they were overly extended, you know? And as a result of that audit, I was greatly encouraged. It was like 50% of the people were serving in the church. It's like 50% of the people were serving. It's like, that's pretty good, you know? And you know, and some of them were doing like two duties, you know? They're doing two things. And some were doing three. And I'd say, oh, these people, they're doing too much, you know? They're doing three things, they're doing too much. But, okay, so you'd say, what would impress me as a church? So let's say you're at a church and you say, oh, let's do a spiritual audit in terms of what people are actually doing and they're utilizing their giftedness. And you, the results are 10% of the people are, I'd say that's an F. That's an F. It's got to be higher than that. You know, and even if I'd say 50, that's kind of low for me anyway. Because really, from the divine perspective, everyone's gifted, you know? But sometimes your giftedness may not be in recognizable church ministry. So you have to allow for that too. Maybe their giftedness with Christians at their workplace, you have to allow for that. So, you know, there's no way of measuring that because you don't know what they're doing unless you interview everybody. But you have to allow for that. But I believe that the more people saw their faith as a ministry, wow, that's the work of the Spirit there. Their life is a ministry. Now, how do you get people to think that way? Oh, it's through teaching. People by default go to church to worship and to listen. To be transformed, to say, but our life is a ministry. Oh, that's a regular teaching, and to develop a sort of framework in the church that fosters that. You know, your life is a ministry. It's God has gifted us. It's partly in terms of how prevalent the teaching of giftedness is in a local church, and because it has to be done regularly. Giftedness, your life is a ministry. Don't put your mind upon the things of this world. Put your mind upon Christ. These are themes that I believe Grace Edmond had. He teach these things. And you got to teach them regularly because you do it once a year, it's not enough. No, it's got to do it regularly because it has to become the fabric. And I once heard a real good sharing by someone and he shared about how to make your church one in which that really prayed and interceded, and he gave really good advice to which I remember to this day, and I apply it to other things. He said, for the church to ever change, the senior pastor has to bleed it. And I knew what he was talking about because I was senior pastor. Because if I want to change, but I don't have the time for it, never going to happen. I have to bleed it. Because when once I bled it, the church began to see how important it was. It was important to Jeff. It's bleeding it. And there's only certain topics you can bleed. And you can always tell the leading pastors, what are they bleeding? What are they bleeding? The pulpit. Because that's what the church becomes. What you bleed is what the church becomes. And it's a really interesting, you know, theory of church, you know. But it's theory of influence and how you influence people. It's not necessary how well you teach a subject. It's really a matter of how much you are passionate for that subject. And you will not take no for an answer on this. And so when I made Sunset, when I was there a praying church, I bled prayer. I bled it. And then it became a praying church. And so, you know, part of this is, I see the role as a shepherd, as a pastor, very, very important in terms of the direction of the church. And the shepherd is not necessarily just a teacher. He's leading the flock to still waters where they need to go, you know. And yeah, that's kind of how I think it happens in my mind, you know. If let's say, like, the one aspect I wanted to change my church in San Francisco was to be a praying church. So I preached about it for 1 year, prayer. I taught prayer for 1 year. Insane amount of sermons on prayer. There's another sermon on prayer. But I went through every major prayer in the Bible. And then I told the people, I think it's time to pray now. And went through everything. It's time to pray. So we started praying. You know? If I would have said, oh, we need to be praying church, but I don't have time because I'm going through the book of Romans. So we'll have assistant pastor A be tasked with prayer ministry, which how churches usually function. It'll never be a praying church. It'll never be. Because the assistant pastor A has no influence. It'll never be. It'll just be a group of people praying. And so usually where the head teacher's heart is, that's where the heart of the church usually is. Usually it follows that way. Okay, Pamela, I think you have the final question.
So does that make me...
Oh, you're breaking up, Pamela. Oh, you're breaking up,
well,
Pamela.
We used to have a lot more pastors, but we don't have a head pastor. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, you have two major teaching pastors in the adult in the main service, and then Andy is a pastor elder, but he's mostly of the recovery service, and so. You know, you did have, when Ray Steadman was here, even though he never had the title lead pastor, he was clearly the most influential person here, you know, and he had a passion. So in terms of, you know, PBC, you could pretty much tell the passion of the two main speakers, you know, what they're with, where they want, you know, what they focus on and things like that. And that becomes what the church is, you know. We, as a speaker, we have some ability to within preaching of the text guide people to where they should be. You know, I know I didn't answer your question. Partly I didn't, you were breaking up, so I didn't really hear it as well. Perhaps you could ask another question, Pamela.
I'll put it in the chat window.
I'll put it in the chat.
Okay, let's see.
I think if we look at R&R ministry, it started out, it was just one individual who wanted to do it. We didn't even have Andy then, or if we had Andy, he wasn't in charge of it. But there was this one gentleman who had, you know, pretty epic experience, jail and, you know, all kinds of things happening in his life that he was transformed, truly transformed by Christ. Mm. He started that ministry, and it's, you know, first times that it met, there were 10 people, and then 20, and then pretty soon there were 30, and then there was 50, and then there was, you know, within a few years, it was 150.
Yeah. Who was the person who started it?
His name was Travis. He actually ended up moving to Texas.
Texas, yes. Spencer mentioned he talked to Travis, and he said yes, he was the founder of the, he started the recovery service. And, you know, Spencer shared that he's moving to Texas at the end of the year. So he had talked to Travis, he shared that last, this last meeting.
Spencer and Faye are moving to Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's too
bad. Yeah, it's kind of sad. They were truly gifted with evangelism, but they're moving. They were supposed to move the end of this month. They're going to move end of the year. So, but, you know, partly I think Travis, and I don't know who Travis is, but I think he probably bled it.
He did.
He bled it. He bled that.
But he was not that. The point I was trying to make is that he wasn't the senior pastor. He wasn't even a pastor.
Yeah.
He was just a member of our church.
That's amazing.
And he grew that ministry. Yeah. And look at it now. I mean,
yeah, that's amazing.
So that can
that
happen.
Is amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. That is more of an anomaly, because usually laymen do not have the type of influence and the ability to do that. Perhaps it was the structure of PBC and that allowed that to happen. But it's surely a work of God for that to flourish and to develop like that.
He bled it because of all the difficulty that he had.
He had.
And he just wanted to help everybody else who was trapped in addiction and didn't have a way out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And his wife fully supported him. Her name is Gay.
Yeah.
Gay. Travis and Gay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the key things that helped Travis was, I think there were a couple of elders that were really supportive of it. Right. I know Ed Woodall
was there.
Yeah.
And he was a very influential elder.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think that's what kind of helped bridge the connection between Travis and his passion and what the Spirit was doing in him and sort of the rest of the PBC leadership at the time, to give him the ability to, or the enough support to step into that and go somewhere.
Oh, thanks for sharing that, Eric and Randy and Christine. Yeah. A name that I have heard in the past, well, in the near past. It's just I heard his name last week. I just forgot it. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, in terms of that, in terms of this theory of the Spirit, I would say that Travis's, that was his burden, spiritual burden. And churches should have a vehicle in which people that have this burden should be able to flourish and to develop the true passion of the heart of individuals. And giftedness. I don't know how it works with the giftedness with R&R and with Step Closer, but there's definitely a passion for it. You know, I mean, there's the various theories of how to run church. I mean, there are theories in which the church organizes things and people join up to do the things that the church has organized. And then there are other theories that says the church doesn't organize a thing. It just keeps on encouraging people to do ministry outside of the church organization. Now, this is more advanced theory of church and of the Spirit. But probably the best church that I know that has the theory that we don't really do anything or promote anything, but we encourage the people to do things, would be Tim Keller's Redeemer Presbyterian. A firm believer that he did not want the church to be overly burdened with administrative things, but to always teach and to encourage the people to do great things for God. And so they would do it outside of the official programs of church. Now that's a very high level decision you make. And most churches don't do it that way. we tend to control the ministry or the program and then have people join in the program that we have developed. I kind of enjoyed Tim Keller's theory as a pastor. I says, wow, it just frees me up. Now I have to organize all this stuff all the time. And I have all those administrative meetings, all organizing, getting recruiting and everything. Just keep on telling people, you're a steward. Your life is a ministry. Do what God has called you. This is what we are. You know, figure out what you can do for God. And so for Tim Keller, and he was the dominant, he's a senior pastor, he's a dominant pastor. It was the consistent message that he always gave. You know, and he did well. I mean, his focus was not on organization, but on mobilization. So that was that. That's an interesting thing. But again, you know, I think with Tim, it is kind of based upon the Spirit's leading and the giftedness of people, of what they will do. Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Oh, final, Janice.
Oh, never mind. It's nine.
No, go ahead.
Well, so I was in the intern program back at the same time as Travis.
Yes.
And I was also in the intern program at the same time as Corrine Klingbeil. I don't know if you have met Corrine. And they had some similarities in that Travis and Corrine was a new adult believer. Like she had become to Christ as an adult, maybe in her 30s, maybe even her 40s. But she was so on fire for Christ because of what he had done for her. So she's there, and then Travis is there, and he was so on fire for Christ because of how Christ had redeemed him. And we would get into these theological debates in the intern class, and kind of the both of them would be like, what, why are we even talking about this? Like, why don't we just keep Jesus at the center? You know, it was interesting to me that they, and Corrine was very much a proponent of deliverance prayer and praying, and you know, so she was more toward those gifts of the Spirit that were, you know, and how that would manifest. It was just interesting to me that both of them would be a little bit like, why do you know, because we would be studying whether the word the was a definite article in script, you know, because we're PBC and we had to, you know, break down every single word. And I just remember Travis getting a little fed up with that and be like, why does this matter? We just need to be out there, you know, winning people for Christ. Why are we making this so complicated? And I think that's sometimes what we can do is make it a little more complicated than it needs to be when the Spirit is a little bit more mysterious and we don't need to figure it all out.
I think, in terms of, you know, how we began, in terms of the free nature of how the Spirit works, we're talking about the worship service. I believe that you have to allow people to perhaps think outside of a box that church leadership has created, because the Spirit is working that way. Okay. It's 9:03, so I'll see you next week for the last class on the Spirit. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you, Christine.
You're welcome, man. I hope Jim's okay.
Yeah, he's not quite okay, but he's, thank you.
Yeah, should I pray for him?
Sure.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you next week, I hope.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.